PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols discusses the legality of using tear gas at the California-Mexico border. Also, a winter storm warning is in effect for the Sierra Nevada. We'll get a roundup of snow conditions as we head toward the weekend. Medicare Part D open enrollment ends next week. We'll revisit Beth Ruyak's conversation with University of the Pacific pharmacy professors about adjusting your prescription drug coverage for the new year. And the sixth annual Stand-Up Sacramento Comedy Showcase is back at the Crest. Headlining comedian J.R. DeGuzman is here to bring the laughs, all for a good cause. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak this week. That's today on Insight. First, here's the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. Thousands of Central American migrants are in the Mexican border city of Tijuana, just south of San Diego, hoping to cross into the United States. On Sunday, a group of several hundred tried to do just that. The U.S. Border Patrol used tear gas to control the situation. Reaction to this move varies depending on who you ask. Supporters of President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigration point to Sunday's confrontation as proof of an invasion. While critics of this policy question the legality of the methods used by border agents. Joining us now is PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols to help us sort through what is really a complicated set of circumstances. As always, Chris, it's really great to have you here.
Good morning, Randall. Great to be here.
So let's back up a little bit for everyone and paint the scene of what's taken place over the past month or so with these migrants.
Well, just to set the stage a bit, we have more than 5,000 migrants essentially camped out in Tijuana, just south of San Diego. And roughly half are from this group that the president and the news media has been sort of tracking over recent weeks that has moved up through Mexico from Honduras up to the southern border. But the other half has essentially been in Tijuana, has been camped out from other groups of migrants that have come and hope to seek asylum into the United States. But the wait times are really long. There's a limited amount of processing going on at the border. The federal government has said that it can only process up to, at the most, 100 asylum claims per day there at the San Ysidro port of entry. And in reality, it's been maybe a few dozen at times per day. So there's really a backlog. There's been a lot of frustrations on the part of the migrants, on the part of the city of Tijuana as to how to deal with thousands of people camped out now at a sports stadium there.
Yeah, the mayor was even calling for a humanitarian crisis at one point.
That's right. Issues of sanitation, food, how to pay for this, and just the human story there in this border city. And so really, it's sort of a mix of what everybody has been watching in recent weeks and a problem that already existed.
One reason there was such a focus on that main caravan coming up is because it was in the days and weeks prior to the election. And so it was being used by both sides.
It was a huge focus of President Trump as, something that he talked almost daily about leading up to the midterm elections as a concern, as reason to send the military to the border. So, yes, it was a big focus.
Now, Chris, you grew up in San Diego. You're very familiar with the San Ysidro land crossing. It's the busiest in the Western Hemisphere.
That's right. Not just the busiest land border crossing in the United States, but in the Western Hemisphere. There are 90,000 people pass north through this crossing each day, 70,000 in cars, 20,000 by foot. These are people who come to the United States to work, to go to school, to shop. It's a normal part of the region. It's a gateway between Tijuana, a large city in itself, and San Diego. It's a huge economic engine for the region. Businesses there rely on these shoppers, these people to come work for them. And right now, from the best I can gather, there's a lot of uncertainty and concern given what happened over the weekend, the protest, the rushing of the border, the use of tear gas, as to whether, and then the temporary closure for a few hours of the port of entry, as to whether, you know, people can get back and forth easily. It's already a difficult situation with a lot of traffic, but now I think there's an added concern.
Yeah, that is a lot of traffic. I mean, it's not quite at the volume of the Golden Gate Bridge, but it's close. So imagine that being shut off. And it was shut off for about 4 hours on Sunday.
That's right. Temporarily, over concerns about migrants gathering nearby, and certainly led to this flashpoint that I think we're going to talk a little bit about with the tear gas and the legality.
Yeah, and so a protest developed because of the backlog.
That's right. My understanding is that given these long wait times, given the weeks and potentially months that migrants could have to wait just to apply, to legally apply for asylum at this port of entry, many were frustrated. They protested over the weekend, and then a group of them did rush up to a border fence, tried to scale it. That's when reportedly were throwing rocks at the Border Patrol.
About a few hundred.
That's right. That's right. And that's when the U.S. Border Patrol agents fired tear gas at these migrants seeking to enter the southwest border.
And that seems to be a point that even at least one member of Congress has questioned the legality of. And what is the legality of using tear gas in a situation like this?
Well, yes, PolitiFact, our national partner, they wrote an article about this. They saw a tweet from Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz, who asked simply, is this legal? He asked, is it moral? Is it accurate? What's happening here? So I think that was really what sparked the curiosity on PolitiFact's part. What they did is they looked at the statements from the Border Patrol. They said that the Border Patrol said their agents were being assaulted. The head of the Border Patrol said a large group rushed the area, were throwing rocks and bottles at my men and women, putting them in harm's way, and that the response was necessary to disperse them from the area. You have other federal officials who have talked about past use of chemicals, including pepper spray, as a deterrent at the border. And then PolitiFact did reach an immigration policy expert at the Cato Institute, who said that the Border Patrol agents have indeed fired tear gas on the border before, and that there does not appear to be any law against it. But I think he also really got to the heart of this matter and the bigger picture of whether this action was necessary, whether it was warranted, which is probably a whole another discussion. But there does not appear to be any law against it. I don't think it's a common practice by any means. But the legality at this point, it does not seem like they broke any laws.
I believe we have some sound from the president on his view.
He was asked directly about this on the White House lawn yesterday.
Are you
They're not, as you know, they're not. They had to use because they were being rushed by some very tough people, and they used tear gas. And here's the bottom line. Nobody's coming into our country unless they come in legally.
And the question there is hard to hear over the sound of the helicopter, and that is, are you comfortable tear gassing women and children?
That's right. And again, the president, as he's said in the past, essentially has described many of these migrants as dangerous, violent people, tough people, and felt that it was justified.
Now, because of all the attention that's been paid to it, some people might be led to believe that this level of border crossing is at a historic high, but that is not true.
Well, my understanding is that the border crossings have actually decreased. I mean, over recent years and decades, the United States has added quite a bit of border security. And certainly during the Great Recession, we saw border crossings drop quite a bit. The added security has made it more difficult. So no, we're not at a period of any sort of historic long-term trend of border crossings. But with the caravans, I think, you know, these moments in time when these groups do come to the border, they are significant large numbers of people. But as far as the trend goes, we're at a pretty low period.
Does the president have the ability to shut down the San Ysidro crossing if he wants to?
My understanding is that he does. I think just looking at some of the reaction from the region, the San Diego region, and the economic concerns are very large. So I imagine there's some pushback there. But as far as the law goes, my understanding is he can at least temporarily do that. Yes.
All right. We're speaking with PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols about the use of tear gas along the Mexico-U.S. border on Sunday. I want to shift gears now, if we can, Chris, and talk a little bit about the devastating campfire. There's been a lot of online talk regarding California Governor Jerry Brown's veto of wildfire legislation. You've reported out a piece for PolitiFact on that.
That's right. For PolitiFact California, our project here at Cap Radio, we published an article a couple weeks ago after these devastating fires. As they were burning, we saw a real flurry of social media and blog posts questioning Governor Brown and his veto from 2 years ago of this wildfire management bill. And it led us to say what was in that bill, why did he veto it? And essentially that veto and all these blog posts were being used to say, or to at least strongly suggest, that if he had signed it, something could have been done about these fires, or they could have been prevented, or they may not have been quite as bad. So we checked it out. There was a bill that he vetoed, essentially a bill that aimed to reduce the risk of power lines sparking fires in wooded areas, much like the area there in Paradise.
And we should say we don't know yet the official cause of the fire for the Camp Wildfire, but there is speculation that it could be related to PG&E power lines.
Exactly. And certainly power lines have caused other fires around the state, devastating fires. And what we did is we looked at the governor's veto message. He puts out letters to explain when he rejects the law. He said that essentially the bill would have duplicated efforts that were already underway by the state, by CAL FIRE and the Public Utilities Commission, to create fire threat maps, to do the same essential thing, to look for areas that were at the most risk of fire due to overhead power lines. And so, you know, that was sort of glossed over in these blog posts or not mentioned at all. People would sort of share the articles, but really there's no real context there about why the governor did this and the ongoing process. I think there's a debate as to whether the process that was in the works was moving fast enough, and whether this bill, even though it was eventually rejected by the governor, whether that sped up the existing process. I think that's hard to know. We didn't place a rating on this, but what we tried to do was just fill in the picture as to what else was going on at the time.
And the outcome of your reporting is that it's really unclear whether this veto had any effect whatsoever on the fires?
I think it's unclear in the sense that, you know, the bill was not passed, so we don't know what it would have done, if it would have sped things up. The Brown administration says it could have actually slowed down the existing process, and that everything in that bill was already being worked on. We did speak with a forestry expert from UC Berkeley, Bill Stewart. He looked at the bill. He looked at Brown's veto message. He told us he did not think it would have made much of a difference because there was not much money attached to it. But he did go on to say that risk assessment and fire mitigation that has been woefully underfunded for decades, and that this could have been, in his words, a shot across the bow to the Brown administration to do more. So it could have been motivation to keep moving on their existing process.
And finally, Governor Jerry Brown is on his way out, and Governor-elect Gavin Newsom is on his way in. You are working on a big project you plan to roll out in January, I believe, and it would be the Truth-O-Meter. How's that going to work?
Well, we, you know, PolitiFact, in addition to the Truth-O-Meter, where we place ratings, either true or half true or false, on claims made by politicians, we also track promises politicians make. Promises as they are candidates running for office. So,
oh, that's right. I'm sorry. The this, promise meter.
It would essentially be a promise meter, and it would focus on Gavin Newsom, now governor-elect Gavin Newsom, and the many promises he made running for governor. Topics that we'll likely look at are housing and health care, homelessness, some of these big, huge, messy topics that Gavin Newsom is certainly pledging to improve. We hope to hold him accountable. We'll lay out an article about the specific promises we're going to track. And then through time, we will publish updates and reports as to whether those promises are being kept, whether they've been broken, whether they've stalled, and hopefully offer our audience a look at some accountability.
No, that's great. And so that'll be a dynamic promise meter that people will want to come back and revisit from time to time to see how many promises are being kept.
Exactly.
So, all right. Our PolitiFact reporter here at Cap Radio, Chris Nichols, on several topics. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Randall.
And you are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. The National Weather Service has a winter storm warning in place for much of the Sierra Nevada, and that extends through Friday morning. The storm system could drop an additional 2 to 3 feet of snow on top of what already accumulated over the Thanksgiving weekend. And more snow is on the way after that. Joining us today is Liesl Hepburn with Squaw Valley Alpine Meadows. Welcome to Insight. Also joining us today is Sarah Sherman with Sierra at Tahoe. Welcome to you both. Let's start with Liesl, and we'll check in with Sarah in just a second. Liesl, what's the scene like there this morning at Squaw Valley?
It's snowy. We got, no surprise, right? We got 7 inches overnight, adding on to the 25 inches we got in last week's storm. And this is really sort of the first of four systems we're seeing through Saturday. So we could be picking up 2 to over 3 feet of snow. So very exciting. We're seeing lots of high winds up, especially at the upper elevations, which might be affecting some of our operations over the next few days. So something to keep an eye on, but that's pretty typical when we get big, big snow events like this one.
And when you say 7 inches, is that at the base or up at the higher elevations?
That is up at the higher elevations.
How is the snow level at the base right now?
We got a couple inches down at the base. It's definitely colder up top, which helps out with the accumulation. You know, having a wet start like this is a good thing in the beginning of the season because it really it's that heavy snow that actually allows us to set a good base up. But we are looking at temperatures to continue dropping for the next three systems coming through. So those, you know, the snow level will progressively go down. So we'll be seeing good accumulation from the base all the way up to the top.
Yeah, I've heard that from more than one person now, that the having an initial heavy, wet base really helps set the snow for the season. Can you explain that just a little bit more?
Sure. So, you know, if you think about when you're making a snowball, right? And good snowball snow is actually the wet stuff, right? You can pack it together in your hand and it really, really sticks together. Whereas very, very cold, light snow is much harder to actually compact into a nice hefty snowball. So it's really the same thing. When we are, you know, we have a lot of terrain here, 6,000 acres, and so having snow with some good density to it helps it to actually really stick to the ground, stick to the new snow that comes in, and then we can groom it and then add snow-making snow on it as well. So it's really good friendly snow for adding on to continuously.
I feel like we're almost reliving the news from last week heading into Thanksgiving. We were talking about these storms coming in and how much it was going to drop. Did those storms live up to their promise?
Yes, absolutely. So we ended up with 25 inches at the upper elevations, which allowed us to open up the upper mountain at Squaw Valley. So, yeah, absolutely. It came in just as forecast, if not a little bit better than forecast. So, you know, our hopes are definitely high for this storm as well. It's setting us up really nicely to open up even more terrain.
How is this in terms of an average year? Are we on track? Is this about where you should be?
Yeah, you know, in terms of opening, we've opened areas that we typically open this time of year. So we're pretty well on track, which is certainly impressive given the limited amount of natural snow we had in October and early November. So heavily reliant on snowmaking. However, now, you know, with last week's storm and this week's storm, we're really pretty well caught up here and looking to expand terrain pretty rapidly here now.
How much of the mountain is open?
So we have 7 chairlifts running right now between Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows. And so that includes both upper mountain and lower mountain at Squaw Valley. And then we have some intermediate terrain open at the lower mountain at Alpine Meadows. I do expect within the next few days, we'll have some updates on really pretty significant terrain expansion at both mountains. So, of course, we'll be looking to see what the weather does, but our teams will be out there prepping. They're already out there building lift ramps and grooming areas. So we're definitely on the brink. And so I think with this extra push from Mother Nature, we'll be popping some things off really quickly here.
How was the turnout over Thanksgiving? Did a lot of people get the word that there was going to be snow?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, of course, there's always tons of great events too going on. So as far as a family holiday, we did see a really nice turnout. We have, we have an aerial tram and snow tubing here as well. So a lot of times for those holiday periods, those non-ski activities are very popular as well. So the word was definitely out about that. And you know, it's also been a nice escape for folks from the fires too. You know, obviously that's died down now that that containment has been reached. But, you know, we were definitely seeing some folks come up to try to get out of the smoke. So it was really nice to see some the relief for some folks coming up the weekend prior to Thanksgiving week as well.
What's the mix, Liesl, right now at Squaw and Alpine when it comes to skiers to snowboarders? Does one mountain over the other favor one sport or the other?
No, it's pretty much, they're pretty consistent between the two. We do see, overall, we see more skiers than snowboarders. But, you know, I think our snowboard population is around, I would say, 30%. But it certainly does, it fluctuates. But it's, you know, it's really pretty welcoming for both sports. So everyone seems to live together pretty peacefully out there on the hill.
And while we're all very excited about the snow for several different reasons, we should mention that through Friday morning, the National Weather Service is recommending that you avoid travel if possible, because you could be stuck in your vehicle for several hours. If you must travel, prepare for long delays and carry an emergency kit. I imagine that's how you pretty much live up there, right, Liesl?
It is, yes, but you bring up a really good point, especially in the beginning of the season when, you know, folks are coming up from your area. It's a surprise when you get up the passes and all of a sudden it's really, really snowing hard, poor visibility, slippery conditions. So we really encourage folks to keep an eye on you know, on the California Department of Transportation, all of their resources. And then for us, you know, we have a great app, the Squaw Alpine app, where you can look and see what the current conditions are, what's open, what's not open, you know, any important advisories for guests coming here, you know, if anything's on wind hold. So similarly, you know, we're affected on the mountain, obviously, as well, with these severe conditions. We're used to it, for sure, but it does definitely impact our operations as well. So we definitely encourage guests to be informed when you before you get in your car.
Lisa, if I remember correctly, there's a plan in the works to connect Squaw and Alpine. Right now, there are two resorts that are adjacent to each other, but there's no way to get from one to the other. Is that plan still in the works?
It is, yes. And there is, we do have an existing shuttle service that does go between the two. So it's really a pretty quick ride to get between the two. But yes, we are looking at putting in a gondola that would connect the base of Squaw Valley with the base of Alpine Meadows. So that's under review now, but we've seen a lot of really positive support for it. It's something that's been dreamed about and talked about for decades, really. And so we're excited to see that come to light in the near future here.
It could ease a little bit of the congestion anyway on, what is that, Highway 1?
Highway 89.
89, I'm sorry. Yeah, Highway 89 there. Lisa Hepburn from Squaw Valley Alpine Meadows with a look at the snow conditions there at Tahoe North anyway. Thank you so much, Lisa. And now let's hop south to Highway 50's Echo Summit and Sarah Sherman with Sierra at Tahoe. Sarah, how does it look where you are?
Hey, Randall. It is looking, just as Artie stated, quite snowy outside. It's been coming down all morning, and it's such a welcome sight up here.
Is it windy?
It's not too windy down here at the base. It's hard to tell at the summit, but we have some great tree coverage here, which really helps us hold in the snow when it does fall, thankfully.
Now, the bulk of these systems, as I understand it, is tracking south. So I would imagine that's good news for resorts on your end of the lake.
It is very good news. We're lucky we've had 24 inches of snow at the summit so far this season, 4 inches overnight, and it's looking like it's going to keep coming down. We're actually scheduled to open the resort this Friday, and we're really happy to have snow in the forecast until then to have a really exciting opening day.
And then on day two, you'll get walloped by another storm, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it's crazy to think of powder skis on an opening weekend, but we're definitely looking at that right now.
Yeah, because the storm that's coming through on Saturday and then subsequent ones on, I believe, like Tuesday and Wednesday, these will be much colder.
Yeah, and so as already stated, we're really, really happy we had some nice, heavier, wet snow come in early in the season. Our base out there is looking pretty solid, and once that heavy snow kind of freezes and consolidates, anything on top is kind of a really nice bonus that makes it feel powdery, even if it's not a huge, huge base depth. So we're pretty excited about that, and having more snow to put on top of that's just a huge bonus.
What is the difference between, say, Sierra at Tahoe and then Squaw and Alpine that we just spoke with? Is it, in terms of date of opening, is it because they have snowmaking equipment?
Yeah, so we do have snowmaking equipment here at Sierra, but we really do rely on Mother Nature to open. So our snowmaking's focused on highly trafficked base area places where people are standing in line to get on lifts, getting off lifts. We're not blowing in the middle of a groomer typically. So it's much more supplemental. So we're really excited that we did get some snow last week and this week, which is really allowing us to open with a pretty good offering.
Sierra at Tahoe slated to open on Friday, as you mentioned. Will the bulk of the resorts open at that time, or are there others that will remain into December?
It really depends on what this storm brings. Right now, we're scheduled to spin 3 lifts, Grandview Express, Knob Hill, and Easy Rider, and we're hoping to have a magic carpet as well because we'll be offering our lessons. But, you know, depending on what this storm brings, we're going to look at what we can open. We're hesitant to say what open terrain will be just because it could snow a ton until then. It could, you know, switch up. So we're looking to have a good opening, and we'll assess day of what we did get and what we can do.
All right. Well, Sarah Sherman with Sierra at Tahoe on Tahoe South's snow conditions. Thank you so much for being on Insight.
Thank you for having me.
And we have more on our website, of course, at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. Open enrollment for Medicare Part D comes to an end next week. If you need to readjust your prescription drug coverage, you have a few more days to explore your options and save some money next year. Last month, Beth Ruyak spoke with University of the Pacific pharmacy professors Raj Patel and Carly Ranson, along with student Caitlin Tipple, about a clinic run by professors and students to help the public pick the right plan. Professor Raj Patel started by explaining how Medicare Part D works and why you need to update it every year.
Medicare Part D is the outpatient prescription drug coverage. So what it helps individuals who have Medicare do, it helps lower their out-of-pocket cost for prescription drugs. And it's a wonderful benefit, but one of the challenges of the benefit are there are quite a few plans, and every plan has a different list of medications they cover and a different cost structure.
Dr. Ransom, if some people are recognizing Medicare D, oh yeah, I know what that's all about, they're already in the system. They can make changes, right? And you're also speaking to people who aren't even there yet.
Correct. So what we do is we target anybody that is a Medicare beneficiary, whether they have prescription drug coverage currently or they're newly eligible for their prescription drug coverage. We help them all the same. We help them navigate through the plan itself to figure out what they're currently in. Is it the appropriate plan for them? Is there a way we can optimize it? Do they need some explanation on what everything is, what everything's going to cost, how everything works? We help them all the same, whether it's new or they are currently enrolled in something. And during open enrollment is when anybody with a prescription drug coverage is actually able to look at those plans and change them if need be.
At what age do you become eligible for Medicare D?
So age is 65, but there are other ways you can qualify for Medicare as well.
Somebody is just hearing this, maybe not quite at 65, and saying, is this now all an online process? And what if my computer skills aren't very good?
Ideally, you would use Medicare Plan Finder tool, which is an online service, but you could call 1-800-MEDICARE, or there are governmental organizations in every county that can help assist as well.
Dr. Patel, are there a few basics that help you know the direction you need to go? For example, if I'm a fairly healthy person, I'm not on a lot of medication, versus I'm dealing with being in remission for cancer or something that's much more complicated from a prescription perspective?
Yeah, not really. There are certain factors that are going to help us, specifically the medications that you're taking. So all the prescription drugs, because every plan is a little different in terms of what they cover. Also, what pharmacy or pharmacies you like to go to, and whether you like to go to a retail pharmacy or a mail order pharmacy. If you have additional governmental subsidies, like if you also have Medi-Cal in our state, that can help us. But the type of plan you like. If you more like one of those burrito plans, as I like to call them, where it wraps up the hospital and medical and prescription drug benefit all under one roof, or if you like a lot more flexibility as to what providers you want to go to and just have a standalone prescription drug plan. Those are some of the factors that we look at based on what's important to the beneficiaries that we're assisting.
Dr. Patel, would you say something about prescription drug costs? I know that's not covered at the healthcare or the clinic, but there are efforts on the state and national level to rein the costs in. How optimistic are you that there's going to be a big impact?
I am optimistic because this is one of the few issues that both parties, both major parties in our country, seem to agree on, both Republicans and Democrats, about trying to curb rising prescription drug costs. So I do think there's going to be both state and federal legislation. One of the big things that they're looking at is transparency on pharmacy benefit management companies called PBMs, or how they're contracting with drug manufacturers for drug costs and making that more transparent to the payers. There's been quite a bit of focus on this issue, and I think there's going to continue to be such until prescription drug costs stabilize or at least grow at a lower rate than the GDP.
The other topic under this big umbrella is opioid addiction and the discussion of opioids. Does that come up? Is a healthcare or clinic an appropriate arena for that conversation?
So I'm smiling because I don't know if you know this, but for the first time, we are actually implementing a program in our Medicare health fairs where we are going to identify individuals that are high risk for opioid overdose, and we are actually going to give them the antidote, the Narcan nasal spray. It's a drug that will help individuals who have an accidental opioid overdose basically resurrect them and bring them back to life so they can get emergency medical care. This stat might blow you away. The United States comprises about 5% of the world's population. Yet we consume 99% of all the hydrocodone and 85% of all the oxycodone in the world. Mm. So 5% of the world's population, 99 and 85% of two drugs that are in opioids, drugs like Vicodin and Norco and OxyContin. And also in our county, one of the two high-risk populations for opioid overdose are seniors. And so we are going to combat this through a three-pronged approach at our Medicare health fairs. One is we're going to give them a drug take-back envelope. So if they have any unused, unwanted, and expired medications, including opioids, they can simply put in the envelope and drop it off in the mail so they'll be properly disposed of for them. The second is we're going to identify if they are, again, high risk for an overdose and give them Narcan along with a packet of information so they know where they can get follow-up doses, treatment centers, and so on. And the third approach is if we identify that there's an issue that we need to communicate with their prescriber about, we'll go ahead and contact the prescriber and make a recommendation for how that problem can be resolved.
The other part of it involves prescriptions and the pharmaceutical companies. And to what extent is the learning and understanding and proactiveness about that part of the problem happening in teaching, in the experience that students are getting?
Yeah, we're trying to incorporate and embed it into the educational experience for students quite a bit, because federal payers, Medicare, for instance, in 2019, they're going to start imposing strict guidelines for how much you can get of opioids, whether it's a new fill, someone who's acute, has acute pain, is taking it for the first time, or someone who's on chronic opioid management. People, students, pharmacists, patients are going to have to rethink this issue because it's not going to be as accessible for many people to get opioids as it has been in the past. And really, the major issue is they are a very effective medication for moderate to severe pain. There's no doubt about it. There are no other medications that are truly as effective in terms of treating pain as opioids. But there are additional modalities that people can maybe take advantage of. Maybe it's acupuncture. Maybe it's, you know, non-herbal medicines, if you will. But Medicare and most federal payers don't pay for those alternative treatment modalities. So there's really the issue. It's if you're going to curb access to medications that are covered or heavily covered by Medicare, what other resources do patients have to effectively manage their pain that's not going to cost them an arm and a leg?
Caitlin, this might be putting you on the spot a bit, but do you feel prepared for someone to say to you, I think I have an opioid problem, or I'd like to have that conversation?
I do. I've spent a lot of time throughout my curriculum with school, as well as these past few weeks, really just fine-tuning how to approach that with the patient and how to be to the best service to them. So I feel like I'm definitely ready to handle that with patients.
Again, we're there to serve the community, and that means in whatever capacity that we are able to and they need.
All right, Dr. Patel, Dr. Ranson, and good luck to Caitlin Tipple. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Professors Raj Patel and Carly Ranson with student Caitlin Tipple from the University of the Pacific Pharmacy School talking about Medicare Part D. Open enrollment ends on Friday, December 7th. And we do have more information and resources on our website, capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Reack today. Tonight is the 6th annual Stand-Up Sacramento Comedy Showcase and auction to benefit Transforming Lives, Cultivating Success, or TLCS. TLCS provides mental health and supportive housing services in the Sacramento region to more than 6,000 people each year. Joining us today is Erin Johansson. She's the executive director of TLCS. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also joining us today is headliner comedian J.R. DeGuzman. He started performing at open mics in Sacramento as a UC Davis psychology student and has come a long way since then. He won the 2016 Stand-Up NBC competition. He's performed all over the world and shared the stage with Margaret Cho, Tim Allen, and many more. You can see him featured on the Netflix show, The Comedy Lineup. JR, welcome to Insight.
Hey, thanks for having me. Stoked to be here.
That's quite a lineup there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I imagine you're...
I'm the least famous on there, so...
I imagine your time as a psychology student probably helps you write some of your material.
You know, it did in a way of like just trying to think about what angles to hit and how people are thinking. But also when I was doing psychology, like I would write jokes during that class like, oh, okay, that's I'm going to write about that. And yeah.
So, sure, the teachers love that.
Yeah, but. Yeah. They only thought I was taking notes, so right. They couldn't tell.
That's true. Aaron, the program is modeled after another comedy benefit that Robin Williams used to do. Yes. Tell us how it all started.
So I don't even remember when Comic Relief started, but the community of comedians with Robin Williams, Whoopi Goldberg, a few others, decided to raise money for homelessness in New York, and they did a lot of work around that. And it was kind of one of the first times that celebrities really got behind assisting a social cause. And so when TLCS was looking for a signature fundraiser, we thought this would be a really cool thing, sort of an homage to that tradition. And we reached out to some local comedians, and JR was one of them in the first year, and asked them to do it, and they got behind it, and they've supported us for the last 6 years.
That's terrific, and it must be nice to have them back.
Absolutely. It's really cool to have watched. For me, it's really cool to have watched JR, particularly in his progression and success in comedy. I was telling him today that he was a high school music teacher. That's what he did before. Mm-hmm. And my daughter is a music teacher. So I have a little soft spot for watching him be successful in following his dreams. It's really cool.
JR, tell us about that first year. What was that like?
Oh, doing this show?
Right.
Oh, man, I had nothing. And then I did this show and I had everything. No, not really, but like kind of.
You mean going into the show, you had nothing in terms of a career.
Yeah, exactly. Man, when you say it, it's so much more depressing. You remember you had no career and just relive that. Yeah. But, so I was like living with my parents and just like doing stand up. And I think I just quit doing like I had three jobs before to support it. And I just quit because I was on the road so much. They were just like, yeah, you can't do this anymore. So I was like, all right, I got to figure something out. And then I was asked to do this show. And we recorded a video from it. And the next like day or few weeks, it went viral, the tape from that show. So I like owe a lot to them. I thought I was, doing them a favor, but they also did me a huge favor. So
yeah, I mean, this has been such a wonderful karmic relationship that we've had, and several other comics have gone on to do some great things that have been our headliners in the past as well. So and it's beautiful to us because the people that don't make very much money when they're out there trying to be a comic and will give their time and their talent to help us help others is very inspiring for us and for my staff. To see that the community comes out and really supports the work they do every day is pretty cool.
What programs do you do every day? What would people recognize?
So the public might not necessarily recognize all the things that we do because we do a lot of things. I mean, 6,000 clients and I have 214 staff. So our core business is we do intensive case management and supportive housing for people with serious mental illness who are chronically homeless. So homelessness is such a big thing in Sacramento and the whole West Coast right now. So more of what we do is really what's needed. And we're really lacking in housing capacity. That's kind of the big problem. And we are also a housing developer, affordable housing developer. So that's some of what we do as well.
I did stories on both of these, but I can't remember which one was which. Proposition 1 or Proposition 2?
Yes. Both will help.
Both will help.
But Proposition 2 is specifically Mental Health Services Act funding that will be dedicated to the build of affordable housing for our population. So, yeah, we are big fans of that legislation for sure. It's really going to help.
And it passed by a wide margin.
It did. It did. And the reason for that is it really doesn't cost the general public anything. It's a carve out of money that was already coming in, but just dedicates it to specifically building housing capacity, which is our single greatest need. Because if a person is homeless on the street, that pursuing their higher self and looking for their to deal with their mental health is less of a priority than finding some place to live. Essentially, that has to be first.
Yeah, it comes from the millionaire tax. If
absolutely,
I remember correctly.
Yes, correct.
JR, this show is a chance to see some old friends and perform in front of the hometown crowd. Yeah. Does that add something to your performance? Mm. Maybe anxiety? I don't know.
It depends how many of my ex-girlfriends come. I'll give them some shout-outs in the crowd. Right. Like, hey, you know. But no, I'm excited to do it. Like, there's the maybe anxiety of, like, sometimes, like, my high school teachers come out. Like, it's real. They'll come out and, like, oh, man, now it has to be good. Otherwise, they're going to be like,
yeah,
we don't believe in it. Like, go back, get another degree. but I'm just excited to, like, see friends and be back in Sacramento. Like, I tour a lot. And so coming back to Sacramento is always, like, a nice, comfortable vacation almost.
Yeah, and the space is big too, isn't
it? It's really big. Beautiful. I mean, the Crest, I think that's one of the reasons the comics like doing it is because the space is big and it's kind of a different kind of venue than they're used to.
Yeah. We're speaking with Aaron Johansson with TLCS and comedian J.R. DeGuzman about the 2018 stand-up Sacramento Comedy Showcase and live auction at the Crest Theater tonight. And we have a little piece of J.R.'s appearance on the Netflix show The Comedy Lineup. This is a bit of a setup about growing up in the Philippines.
But I am an immigrant myself. I was born in the Philippines. Oh, snap. Heck yeah, man. A bunch of nurses in here. That's tight. That's so cool. That's so crazy. You guys work hard. You have a day off. That's beautiful. Mabuhay, by the way. Mabuhay. If you don't speak Tagalog, that means let's take over at 11:30. This entire room is coming. I was born in the Philippines. I was born in Pangasinan. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know how Pangasinan rolls, right? Like, what can I say about Pangasinan that hasn't already been said? Like, those jokes are so overdone, right? You guys are like, comedy show, probably just gonna hear a bunch of Pangasinan jokes. You guys know the saying, like, what happens in Pangasinan? Yeah, no, that's not it. It's what happens in Pangasinan is very corrupt.
Okay, that's terrific. Are there any topics that will be off limits at tonight's performance?
Whatever they tell me, I can't say.
It's kind of a we tell the comics it's a PG-18 show. It's not for kids for sure, but we don't want them to go way down in the dirt. And I also was telling JR earlier that the group that we work with, I just appreciate that their humor is elevated. You know, they're smart comedians and their writing mm-hmm. is good. So you will have fun, you will laugh, and you will not be assaulted by, you know, the F word or whatever.
Yeah, and your humor doesn't really rely on that anyway.
Right. Yeah, yeah. At least, like, right now. So, but maybe when things start going south, I'm like, I'm going to pull out the dirty stuff and, like, you know.
There's only so much you can say on NBC.
Right? Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like when being part of that competition?
Yeah, it was, it kind of brought out a lot in me to see, like, there was a lot of challenges if you have to be clean and then kind of tell your story as well, like, those two things within a short set. And so it kind of brought out in me, like, who am I as a comic? And so that, it kind of helped me a lot, actually. Uh-huh.
And what does inspire you as a comic? I mean, clearly your heritage and that mm-hmm. Comes into it, but what else?
I mean, I do a lot of musical comedy too. And so just, I really like to just be silly as well. So, like, a lot of stuff from my family, culture, all these things, and, like, kind of heavy topics, but I like to try to make it, like, palatable, you know, because we already get so much, you know, bad news all the time and things going on. It's like, okay, let's talk about stuff, but make it in a way that's fun.
And yeah, and your musical clips are hysterical as well.
Thanks.
And we will be sharing one of those at the end of this segment here.
Yeah.
So stay tuned
one of the
as
clean
you're
ones,
listening.
Thanks.
Yeah. So you had to be here early for this show, and then you're performing tonight. What's the timing of the show tonight?
So the VIP reception starts at 5:30, and the doors open to the theater at 7, and then the show starts at 7:30. But we have a little mission and the live auction with David Soban going on first. So the comedians start about 8:15.
Is this your big fundraiser for the year?
Yes, it's our signature event that we've been doing for 6 years. Yeah.
How else do you get your funding, aside from, like, we just mentioned Proposition 2?
Yes,
and
so we are mostly government-funded, but we also are supported by several different foundations in town, Dignity Health, Sutter, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, those folks as well.
Right. Well, it's great having you both here, and it's always nice to start the morning with a chuckle, which I just did for sure. I'm not sure how much my mic was up during that clip, but I was laughing a lot, a lot for that. We were speaking with Aaron Johansson with TLCS and comedian J.R. DeGuzman about the 2018 Stand-Up Sacramento Comedy Showcase and live auction at the Crest Theater tonight. And Aaron, I should have asked, is it sold out?
It's not sold out, and so you can still get tickets today. So they are at, they are available at standupsacramento.com or at the Crest itself. The Crest box office will be open a couple of hours before the show, and you can just get your tickets there.
Yeah, and as always, we put all of that information up online for everyone at capradio.org. Aaron and JR, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer, however, was Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Jesus came back for Lance. Oh, I said if there were more mixed babies, I said there'd be no World War II. If the Japanese were half white, said there'd be no Pearl Harbor. They'd all return to avoid getting sunburned. Cause white people got sensitive ass skin. If Hitler was half black, said there'd be no Sieg Heil, just power to the people. Interracial baby, said daddy's here. Beyonce Cutler baby, the 1950s weren't our year.
Yeah, racism's over. Just like that. Feels so good. Feels so good for racism to be over like that.